Welcome to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
We have a cultural mythology that meat eating bestows virility and masculinity, not only on the individual, but also on the culture. Secondly, that there is a connection between violence against women and violence against animals that we consume as meat. What does it mean that we do not recognize animals as beings who want to live? I'm not trying to make anybody feel guilty. I want people
with the United
to start
States having essentially conquered the North American continent, the United States could become a global imperial power, but in order to do that, it needed to follow really in the traditions of England. To be an island power, it needed to control the seas. In order to control the seas, it needed a network of bases around the world. Back in the 1890s, the major concern
was for peaceable kingdoms.
China
this
trade.
Week on Soundings, I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations about pacifism, feminism, and vegetarianism. You'll hear from Carol Adams and from Joseph Gerson. Carol Adams will discuss her book, a volume entitled The Sexual Politics of Meat, a Feminist Vegetarian Critical Theory. Carol Adams teaches at the Perkins School of Theology in Dallas, Texas. Following that, I'll talk to Joseph Gerson about his book, entitled The Sun Never Sets, Confronting the Network of Foreign U.S. Military Bases. Joseph Gerson is Peace Education Secretary for the American Friends Service Committee. Carol Adams's book explores cultural myths, meat-eating, manliness, and social domination. The Sexual Politics of Meat is available from Crossroads Continuum Press.
There is a word that comes to mind, triumphalism. We're at the top of the heap. We've earned what we've got. We are where we are because God, nature, politics, whatever you want to call it, has put us there. Why do you want to upset this apple cart?
Well, women are already upsetting that apple cart. Women are already saying this hierarchical worldview was created by a Western male ethos that not only put men over women, but whites over people of color, and also humans over animals.
Well, now, wait a minute. Aren't you moving backward in time and imposing upon men and women, men particularly, I suppose, who lived hundreds of years ago, an ideology that is now fashionable? How can you accuse them? I mean, how do we extract from them a behavior that just wasn't part of the way they thought?
Except that if you look even further back in history, we are a predominantly vegetarian species. For most of the 3 million years that we have evolved, we were vegetarian. Hunting only entered as a significant part of our life about 100,000 years ago. And it isn't really till about 10,000 years ago that we have hunting in any way that's glamorous, hunting of big animals rather than scavenging dead carcasses. I mean, we don't really even think of man the hunter as someone who's killed babies or scavenged dead animals. So first of all, if we're really looking at who we are, we might argue that these notions of triumphalism only entered recently, and that to recapture what our past is, we have to step back.
When you use, Carol Adams, a phrase like who we are, what you're doing is inviting us to think philosophically, categorically. I think the 50-cent term for it here is ontologically. Why do you find that compelling? Now, you know, again, I want to press you for this connection between the abstraction and the real world, the feminism, the vegetarianism, and the way we live.
The way we live is as acculturated people. We question a lot about our lives, but we are so acculturated about meat being food that when someone comes along and wants to split that and say meat is not food, the first reaction is either I'm trying to make you feel guilty because I think I'm better than you, or that I'm neurotic, that I'm worse than you.
And you're not doing that.
I'm not trying to do that. I'm trying to lift up something that our culture represses. Our culture represses the truth about what we do to animals. I want to ask, why do we need to repress it, and why are we doing it?
Tell me, be personal and anecdotal for me. What was the moment of conversion for you? Don't take too much time, but just, you know, focus on that for a moment.
Two things converged for me. When I was a first-year student at Yale Divinity School, I had a growth on my thyroid. And in reading about what causes cancer, which we thought it might be, I learned that meat eating was very implicated in a variety of forms of cancer. Now we know from the research of Colin Campbell that was announced earlier this year, that meat eating is definitely linked to the major forms of cancer that's killing human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So that got me to thinking, but what brought it home was that a horse of mine was killed by some hunters. And that night I had some hamburger, and I brought the hamburger to my lips and I thought, I am eating a dead cow. I would not eat my dead horse, so why am I eating a dead cow? And I realized I was a hypocrite,
mm-hmm.
and began to examine what does it mean to be eating dead animals.
Well, let's move from the particular and the personal to some rather larger elements here in your book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, Carol Adams. You dedicate this book to 6 million each year, 16 million each day, 700,000 each hour, et cetera, et cetera. You're talking about animals who are sacrificed for the human consumption.
In the United States alone.
Right. And this brought to mind the dedication that Toni Morrison uses in the beginning of her novel, Beloved. It also brings to mind the Nazi Holocaust. Now, isn't that just a bit of an outrageous comparison? You're talking about animals and McDonald's and, Hamburger King and all of that sort of thing, and human beings who have died?
First of all, the comparison's in your mind. I don't make that comparison
my
memory.
You put it at the beginning of your book.
That's right. But I don't make the comparison in the beginning of the book. All I make are flat statements. Indeed, 6 billion are killed each year.
Numbers.
That's right. 6 billion animals each year. I think that's a stunning number.
Uh-huh.
We do not step back from our piece of steak at a dinner table and think of how it fits into a livestock industry.
Uh-huh.
It's very disembodied. Not only is it disembodied from the animal, but disembodied from the production process.
Okay, so the numbers are different. But what about the categories?
Okay.
That's what I'm pressing you to find out. I mean, I'm trying to be impertinent here. This outrageous comparison between animals and human beings.
You're making the comparison by assuming that it is wrong for us to know the numbers.
That we're better and they're worse?
That's right. But animal rights have coined the term speciesism. Speciesism is that notion that humans are better and deserve a different ethical treatment than animals.
Mm-hmm.
It's speciesist to believe that we cannot enumerate animals who died, but we can enumerate humans who've died from human inhumanity.
All right. Well, now, if it's speciesist, we have to make some major changes in the way we think. This is where you're leading this argument, I take it, Carol Adams. In other words, we have to move from the philosophical and the sociological and the cultural into the theological. You're asking for a sea change in human nature, the human heart itself, right?
I think feminism already asks for that. And as a feminist, I stepped back from society and said, what is going on here that women's work is undervalued, underpaid, that women are not in positions of power? We're already asking for a sea change there.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that the feminist conceptual system that is talking about unnecessary violence, that is talking about the inability to recognize the rights and needs of other beings, applies as well to animals.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, a sea change is necessary. We believe we are meat eaters. But part of the reason we believe we are meat eaters is because we live in a male-dominated world that has created the image of man the hunter as its cultural hero and imposed that on us as individuals.
One of the arguments that you make in this book, Carol Adams, The Sexual Politics of Meat, goes to the words that we use, the language that we use. You talk about breast men, leg men, sexism inherent in the language. Aren't you trivializing the issue? Why can't we have these relatively innocuous vagaries in our language?
Well, they may be innocuous to you, but as someone who's experienced men who like to talk about women's breasts and women's legs, or Frank Perdue saying, are you a breast man or are you a leg man? That double entendre is directly assaultive to my female body.
Well, what about women who call men hunks?
Well, what is interesting there is that meat, when it's used to describe men, is often very positive.
Uh-huh.
Meat, when it's used to describe women, is assaultive.
It is not.
So that women are pieces of meat or pieces of butchered meat.
Mm-hmm.
The way that pornography, I talk about Larry Flint's Hustler magazine, putting a woman through a meat grinder and saying, we're no longer going to hang women up like pieces of meat. I do not take comfort in an image like that. I do not see that as a positive image. I think that...
You take that very seriously as a cultural, philosophical issue and not as what the antics of a trivial mind, part of the entertainment industry.
It is part of the entertainment industry, but it's so deeply implicated in the entertainment industry. For instance, let's talk about the cover of my book. On the cover of my book is a woman, a naked woman, who you see her back and her rear end. Mm-hmm. And she's divided up as though she is a piece of meat.
She's wearing a cowboy hat, and the caption says, "What's your cut? Chuck, rib, loin, rump, round, etc., etc."
When I lived in Boston, this poster hung in practically every butcher shop in the Haymarket section of town.
Well, it's just a variation on the old calendar, the old cheesecake thing. That's
a variation that implies that women are pieces of meat and that women are to be cut up, dissected, to be experienced in the same way that animals are. Mm-hmm. So that animals are the preceding trivialized beings upon whom women's trivialization is built.
So this logic extends to the human race rather than the animal kingdom.
I think the logic descends from what we do to animals, uh-huh, and then is applied to those vulnerable beings in our world who are women. So I'm not trivializing the language. I'm trying to say that what is happening in the language is two things. The language trivializes what we do to animals by renaming dead, scorched corpses as filet mignon, and it trivializes women by then equating women with these dead, scorched corpses. Uh-huh. That the trivialization is inherent to our language, which must deny the truth of violence against women.
You're telling me that the language is a symptom and not a cause. It is symptomatic of deep, disturbing trends,
right,
in our nature.
That's right. And I'm not trivializing it so much as trying to lift it up, mm-hmm, and say, let's examine the truth of what we're doing. Why does our language need to mask what we're doing? And why does this masked language then get applied to women?
Where do we go, Carol Adams? How do we make these changes? If you had some magic philosophical wand or cultural device that you could bring to bear on the American sensibility, how are you going to make these changes? How are you going to reverse all that history and counter all of that, what you perceive to be sexism and all these isms coming together again?
I see you're not willing to admit that it is sexism, only that I perceive that it is. Feminist philosopher Marilyn Frey talks about seeing with an arrogant eye or seeing with a loving eye. Uh-huh. The arrogant eye creates objects, creates distance. The loving eye recognizes the independence of the other. If we see with a loving eye, if we approach our life with a loving eye, then we can't objectify Central Americans. We can't objectify cattle. Mm-hmm. We can't objectify women. So I'd say that we need to have a conceptual switch. How do we then have a dietary switch? Many people recommend visiting a factory farm or visiting a slaughterhouse.
Oh, yeah, laws and sausage. Isn't that the, you don't want to see them made?
True. And one of the interesting things I talk about is Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle.
Right.
He only used the slaughterhouse as a metaphor. His whole point was the treatment of the worker. But because he was so explicit in describing the slaughterhouse, people begged for a law that would protect them from getting meat like that. And many, many people became vegetarians.
Weren't they worried mainly about the health aspects, the aspects of hygiene, rather than the issue of diet itself?
Well, they were very upset, uh-huh, reading about the poor pig having her throat slit and then being bled out. I mean, people had a very visceral reaction to what constitutes 12 pages out of a 300-page book. Mm-hmm. That information is very powerful. We repress it in our society. I think we repress it because it feeds into our notion of this sort of false masculine ego that our culture itself represents.
Mm-hmm.
Again, think of the man the hunter image. Man the hunter for hundreds of thousands of years was not this valiant man stabbing the huge woolly mammoth.
Uh-huh.
He was scavenging dead corpses. We don't think of that. That is not how we image ourselves. We need to, first of all, just start speaking the truth. Now, when vegetarians speak the truth, they're thought to be emotional.
Nuts, fringy,
right,
you know, soft, touchy-feely.
All you have to do is say dead, butchered animal at a table, and people think you're being very emotional.
Yeah, not to mention turning them all off.
But, of course, that's all the truth.
Yeah.
That is exactly what's being eaten. And I think the feminist analysis comes along and says, why aren't we speaking the truth? What are we repressing and why?
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Carol Adams. Your book is The Sexual Politics of Meat. If we have women who run the world and who eat nothing but grains, does that mean that we're going to have a better life, that war is going to go away, that our problems are going to be solved? Where does it all lead us?
I'm not valorizing women as somehow equipped with some deep feminine intuition. I'm saying historically, though, women have not been equated with hunting or with the cattle industry, that historically we might have something to learn from looking at where women stood. Anthropologically, we have something to learn from the fact that gathering societies where women gathered and shared their protein sources were egalitarian. It says something to us that animal-based economies are economies where men war, where there's rape, and where women are very unequal.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that that anthropological schema fits directly onto the United States makes me sit back and say, let's talk about why do we feel we need protein from a dead butchered animal who we think is giving us strength and is actually killing us.
Here's a quick footnote to our conversation, Carol Adams. What are you going to do in societies where it's unavoidable historically and in contemporary terms for people to go out and kill animals and eat them? I mean, they don't have the alternatives, I take it, that you're suggesting, for example, for American society.
Well, let's start with American society. American society is really contributing a great number of problems because of its dependence on animals.
We're the bad guys, setting the bad example.
Well, American and Western culture, but especially Americans. We've believed that meat was part of our right as Americans.
Uh-huh.
It's very tied up with our notion of the expanding frontier. It's when people immigrated here, it was one thing they knew they were going to get. In fact, cattle were offered to people to come in the 17th century. So meat eating is very tied up with our own self-image. That's why the dedication of $6 billion each year is talking about the United States. I'd say let's look to the United States itself. Let's think about alternate ways of getting protein. Let's support alternate protein sources.
So if we change it here, then we're going to set the trend for these other societies.
That's right. And let's deal with the fact that our culture still is feeling a need to prove its macho nature on the world court and express itself in a very masculine way internationally, and challenge that as well. I mean, it's a feminist vegetarian critical theory that's trying to intersect these two and challenge both the man and the hunter image as they intersect.
Carol Adams teaches at the Perkins School of Theology in Dallas, Texas. Carol Adams' new book is The Sexual Politics of Meat, a Feminist Vegetarian Critical Theory, available from Crossroads Continuum Press. You're listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Peaceable Kingdoms continues. You'll hear next from Joseph Gerson, co-editor of a new volume entitled The Sun Never Sets, Confronting the Network of Foreign U.S. Military Bases. Joseph Gerson is Peace Education Secretary for the American Friends Service Committee. The Sun Never Sets is available from Southend Press. According to Joseph Gerson, the American military presence overseas includes more than 500,000 personnel serving on 375 bases, a network that dates back to the time of President Theodore Roosevelt.
I'm tempted to just say to you, aren't you really just very naive by writing a book like this and talking about what the decline of our democratic ideals, in fact, you call it the corruption of the morality of democracy that this network of bases represents. Let's begin with that. I mean, you've been called naive, I suppose, before. What about it?
Where I would respond, I guess, is to say that I take my democratic values seriously and expect them to be practiced by others. The second is that second and third is, you know, the Friends Service Committee and the Quakers root values are in perceiving that of God in every person, recognizing the rights of each individual to the equal rights of each individual to live a free life and to have possibilities. I'm also Jewish, and for me, I find the older I get, the more I go back to the Holocaust, the need to speak out against crimes, the need not to participate or be complicit in them, and to urge that others in my society look at the world we really live in and to respond.
How do you account for the essential indifference of the American people, as I read your book, to this network of bases around the world? We all care about, well, how much the eggs cost and whether we're going to have to pay for our cable TV and all of that stuff. But we don't pay attention to these things that go on the other side of the planet that represent us.
I don't have a comprehensive answer to that. I think there are many things. I think one, the consumerism and materialism of our society plays a deep role. We're preoccupied with immediate gratification. Like people all over the world, we're preoccupied with getting through the day, mm-hmm. having a job, looking after our families. And what's further away is more difficult to envision or to identify with. I think there are also deeper roots going back to the origins of our society in terms of the idea that this was to be a city on the hill, that Americans were somehow better.
Isolated?
The isolation didn't last long. But also, I think, racism, mm-hmm. The idea that, in essence, white Christians and white Christians in the New World had the answer for the rest of the world. And this has been a pattern which I think has been at war with our basic democratic values throughout our history.
Now, we talked, Joe Gerson, about what's away from us, what's on the other side of the planet, what's close to home. Let me present you with a hypothetical situation. Suppose Saddam invaded your home. Mm-hmm. What would you say? Are you still going to look sort of wide-eyed and say, I don't want to kill anybody, I don't want to hurt anybody, we don't need these means of protecting ourselves? How about that?
As I had to confront in the time of the Vietnam War, whether or not I was a pacifist, building on what I had learned from Martin Luther King's nonviolent struggle, I think I came to believe that on some levels I might defend myself individually. I might. But in terms of the kinds of war that are being fought in the last half of the 20th century, in terms of the kinds of war that I and others in my society would be called on to fight, I could see no way to participate in that. And as we're recording this program now, the president yesterday said, you know, I just really didn't expect what was going to happen to the Kurds. Mm-hmm. His great war for self-determination and freedom put back a monarchy, which has been killing and torturing Palestinians in much the same way that Kuwaitis were killed and tortured by the Iraqis.
Well, what you're doing is urging the American policymakers not to be so expedient, not to take expediency, not to have that so close to home.
The other thing was there were other alternatives.
Okay.
Tell
me about it. For example, with Saddam.
With Saddam, the most obvious alternative is the one that Bush has had to fall back on now, which is economic sanctions. Mm-hmm. No one believed that economic sanctions could bring down his government in 5 months. And you look at the contradictions. I mean, we had to bring the Reagan administration kicking and screaming to sanctions against South Africa, international sanctions which were porous, which the Japanese didn't participate in. And over a period of more than a decade, it forced the apartheid government of South Africa to negotiate with the African National Congress.
So you point to that and say this kind of policy actually works. It has practical results.
It works. You also look at Zimbabwe. Uh-huh. One that is not so dear to my heart is the case of Nicaragua. But we can see that there are other means, and a vast proportion, former secretaries of defense, former heads of the CIA, all said this was the way to go. In fact, the sanctions were I don't think ever seriously contemplated as a policy. They were simply a means to provide the political cover, both internationally mm-hmm. and within the United States, to fight the war that Bush anticipated on August the 2nd.
Yeah. Joe Gerson, your book is The Sun Never Sets, Confronting the Network of Foreign U.S. Military Bases. Let me recall something that you and I exchanged before our taping session. You said that you don't believe in a dictatorship of the left. Hmm. If you don't believe in a dictatorship of the left, what is the left going to do about these bases?
Our experience was that no one in the United States, almost no one in the United States, knows of the existence of these bases, knows the disproportionate impact of bases on women, mm-hmm. Knows their impact in Portugal or in Greece, the chapter on bases in Comiso. You cannot have a policy debate if no one knows the issues. If people are coming to you from all over the world and say, we're suffering, and no one in the country knows that people are suffering, it's difficult to alleviate or even to respond to that. So what the American Friends Service Committee did was to move to edit this book to not only draw chapters from experts here in the United States, but from people all over the world, and to present it to people here in the United States so we can begin a discussion. We can begin to explore what's here. We can begin to debate the rights and wrongs of it. And I think from that, a number of policy issues, a number of possibilities for changing policy will emerge.
What does the so-called end of the Cold War have to do with the arguments that you're making here, that we ought to get out of the military racket?
Well, as we were writing it, I was talking with my co-editor. I really pushed for us to go back to the pre-Cold War period in describing the history of the accumulation of U.S. bases, because I think what's happened with the end of the Cold War is the rationale for the building of bases, most of which were oriented not really against the Soviet Union, but for intervention in the Third World, that rationale is gone. And so now we face the world, if you will, in a somewhat clearer way. We can see what's there without the some of the illusions that were put before us, which is not to say that the Soviet Union was all sweetness and light by any means. And now I think where we are is, and in part what the Gulf War was about, is we are in a world of three economic superpowers and only one military superpower. But my deepest fear is that by continuing to reinforce militarism and military responses to the world, the economy of the United States will continue to decline. And we will find the people of the United States in much worse situation and condition than if we look to have a more balanced domestic and foreign policy.
Joseph Gerson is Peace Education Secretary for the American Friends Service Committee. Joseph Gerson is co-editor of a new volume entitled The Sun Never Sets, Confronting the Network of Foreign U.S. Military Bases, published by Southend Press. You're listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Peaceable Kingdoms is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 567. That's program number 567. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete summary of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings.
You've been listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Next week, the topic will be family memoirs. Wayne Pond will talk with the English writer Nigel Nicholson and the Irish literary critic Dennis Donahue. Nigel Nicholson will discuss his book, Portrait of a Marriage, a remembrance of his parents, the diplomat Harold Nicholson, and the novelist Vida Sackville-West. Dennis Donahue will talk about his most recent book entitled Warren Point, a memoir of his Irish boyhood. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Peaceable Kingdoms, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for conversations with Carol Adams of the Perkins School of Theology and with Joseph Gerson of the American Friends Service Committee. Adams will discuss her book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, a Feminist Vegetarian Critical Theory. Joseph Gerson will talk about his book entitled The Sun Never Sets, Confronting the Network of Foreign U.S. Military Bases. Peaceable Kingdoms, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.